This is Tracy Swedlow, editor-in-chief of Interactive TV Today and co-producer of the TV of Tomorrow show.
And this is Colin Dixon, founder and chief analyst at Endscreen Media. And this is Tea Time.
Tea Time.
It is indeed. And Tracy, we are just a few days away from the TV Tomorrow show in San Francisco. And boy, do you have a great lineup this year. I'm really excited about who I'm talking to. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little
bit. You have a great set. You have a great set of sessions, Colin. Really good.
I sure do. I guess, you know, I should mention we've got Jennifer Prenner, who is GM and head of marketing at for Fire TV, Amazon. I talked to Jennifer a couple of weeks ago, and she is awesome. That's going to be a great conversation. I'm also talking to Rebecca Dopp at Google, and she's heading up Google's news initiative in TV. So that will be really good, talking a lot about local news and local media. And I'll, of course, be doing my infrastructure panel.
Of course, you must do infrastructure, understanding the FAST ecosystem, F-A-S-T. That has John Cody, TV4 Entertainment, World, Zype, Zumo, Stir. You've got Adam Ware from Sinclair on his new offering, Stir, which is really amazing. And Zone TV.
If our readers haven't tried it, they really should, because it's got your local news, and it's got a whole bunch of other stuff in there as well. And give you a hint on where Sinclair is headed. But today we have a special guest, and that's John Guidengack, and he is principal at Hub Research. John, welcome.
Hey guys, how are you? Thanks for having me.
John, but isn't Guidengack? You've never actually told me it is. Okay.
Oh, you got all right. It. You got it. I usually don't correct people. It's not a. If I call it, Colin is pretty close for the first try. Yeah,
we just call you John anyway. Guidengack is quite, you know, a little complicated, but all good. So we're so thrilled to have you. Of course, you have moderated at TVOT and presented lots of data from Hub Research in the past, a bunch of our events, and we're thrilled to have you on the show because you have just put out this marvelous report, which we're going to talk about.
The best bundle. And John, we just thought that this data relates to so much that we're going to be talking about at the TV of Tomorrow show, that it would be a great preparation for our listeners to listen into before they come. So the best bundle, why don't we talk about, let's start out by talking about people's personal TV bundles today, because they're pretty different than they were just a few years ago, right?
Yeah, they are. One of the things that people really like about the changes in the TV industry are all of the options they have available now when it comes to what to watch and where to get it from. And this is evidenced by, you know, I think a lot of the attention gets paid to people that are subscribing to things like Netflix, but really the number of services that people are using either occasionally or frequently goes much deeper than that. So one of the things that we do in this study is we ask people about all the different ways that they watch TV, from traditional pay TV to SVODs to free ad-supported platforms. And then in the analysis, we total it up and see what's the average number per user. In 2019, we're up to about 4.5 different sources of television used per respondent. And it's even higher if we look at younger people. So people from 18 to 34 use 5.5. And, you know, as we might talk about in this conversation, that gives people access to lots and lots of content, but it also creates some friction points and some needs that wouldn't have existed even just a few years ago as people try to navigate all those and choose what they're going to watch from so many different sources.
It's interesting to me that, you know, and we're going to go into it in more depth, but, you know, we obviously see the top three services being used, but I didn't see any mention of YouTube at all. I'd be very curious to how people use or don't use that, but maybe that's a younger set.
Yeah, well, and actually in this question, we were only asking people about premium kind of long form TV content. So if you add in things like user produced video or, you know, short form or digital first, and, you know, it gets kind of hard in a survey to sort of perfectly classify those things. But certainly if you look at things that people are consuming on a more casual basis than they would watch premium TV shows and movies, that's a whole other ball of wax. And it's something that we've done other research on that to see how consumption of that video impacts consumption of premium video, and they definitely compete for the same time. And people that watch more of that YouTube video do, it's not a one-to-one replacement, but they do tend to watch less premium video from premium sources. And that's why one of the things we're paying attention to is work by, you know, some networks like Viacom or things like Facebook Watch to better commercialize that type of video, because we think that's an area where there's a lot of opportunity to create more professional, more professionally produced content that will really attract an audience.
I would love to see how YouTube TV comes out next year, because, you know, they have a lot of the components you have mentioned in your report that people want, like live TV and access to, you know, all sorts of movies and originals. But anyway, we're digressing because they're not mentioned in your report. All right. I just wanted to bring up that as something that people should watch, I mean, or should you know, monitor, rather, the rise of YouTube TV.
So, John, what are we talking about in that 4.5? Is that pay TV, Netflix, and a couple of others?
It's actually, so it's pay TV, and it could also include online sources of TV that you get through your pay TV subscription, like TV Everywhere authenticated. It also includes any of the SVOD platforms. It includes any of the free ad-supported platforms like Pluto or Crackle. And it does include people that are using virtual MVPD, so Hulu with Live TV, Sling TV, YouTube TV. So those are all lumped in there. The virtual MVPDs are still pretty small. And in many cases, one really interesting thing actually is that we're finding that there are a lot of people who have both a virtual MVPD subscription and a traditional MVPD pay TV subscription. And we've kind of been digging into that. It's something that a lot of our clients say they're finding this too. You know, it's just another example of people having two sources that on paper do exactly the same thing, but some people use both of them because they are letting someone outside their home use the virtual MVPD subscription, or because many people are on sort of a trial, either a literal free trial, or they're just trying it out before they cut their cable cord completely. You know, just another example where people are sort of combining these services in unexpected ways, and in that way, you know, diffusing their disposable time, which is about the only thing that's remained consistent as everything else grows, that time being sort of diffused across more and different TV options.
It would be interesting to see if they're marketed together, or, I mean, if people tend to sign up for a VMPD when they already have that particular, you know, MVPD that owns that VMPD, you know, I mean, if they use other ones that they find that are not necessarily tied together.
So I just have to have my little gripe, by the way, here. I think VMVPD is an awful term. I wish we hadn't embraced that. I was trying to get us to use VPOP, virtual pay TV operators, but that seemed to me that was a lot easier to say.
I think our industry is, you know, there are a lot of acronyms that get used, not because they're particularly good, but just because they happen to be the ones that are used and are the ones that are the most familiar. But it's certainly a array of providers that sort of define a clean classification into really distinct categories, because there's always some that come along that that fall in between somehow. And if it's, you know, if it's confusing for us in the industry, you can imagine what it's like for the average consumer.
I actually had to explain to someone how the industry uses the term connected TV versus smart TV, and you know, what's marketing speak versus what's and you know, it's very confusing, because actually the industry is starting to use connected TV sometimes for everything, and it's just such a mess. But anyway,
very
let's
confusing.
Get back to your topic.
Yeah. So John, we sounds like we have these bundles of services that we're using on a fairly regular basis. What makes us happy about that bundle?
Well, people really like having options. So if you figure that, you know, not too long ago, a regular pay TV subscription was your only choice, and because you couldn't really get TV from anywhere else, customer satisfaction was not necessarily a huge priority. There is enthusiasm among people for having more options. Especially among younger people, they feel positive about the growth of TV services and the number of places, not just in the growth of content, but in the number of places there are to get content from. People are also really excited about the option to watch when you want to watch, and kind of a huge subset of that is binge viewing. Not everybody binge views, but people that do tend to watch that way most or even all of the time. you know, that's one of the things that I think is an example of the kind of thing I think is really interesting about the changes that are going on in the industry, because binge viewing really fundamentally changes what it means to watch TV. And it has a huge impact on what gets consumed. You know, instead of someone deciding what to watch every Thursday at 8 o'clock, what they're going to watch from 8 till 9, every time they make a decision about what to watch, if they're a binge viewer, maybe they're making a decision about what to watch from this Thursday night at 8 until 2 Thursdays from now. And that'll be the next time they make another decision. So it really puts much more weight on every time a consumer makes a selection about what they're going to do next. So that's a challenge, but it's also a big opportunity, because you can create, and Netflix is actually a really good example of kind of the first company to do this, but other companies are following suit now, where you can create content that's specifically designed to be binge viewed, where the story arc is created differently, and maybe the number of episodes is different, because we found that people would much rather binge something that's, you know, 8 to 10 episodes than something that's 22 episodes long. But that's, I mean, and I think that's something where there's a lot of room to kind of adapt content to the way that people are watching and create a much stronger engagement with an audience by evolving the product to the way that people are using it today.
So my comment is, I recently watched several weeks, once a week, of the PBS Les Miserables series, the new version of Les Miserables. And I found that I didn't feel compelled to sign up for their special pass to be able to binge view all of their stuff. I was willing to wait, you know, each week to watch the next episode. And it was like, okay, I look forward to it, but it's like appointment TV again. I could watch it when I wanted to watch it that week after it came out. But to be honest, it did not drive me to subscribe to their service. And I feel that if it had been, you know, a binge only option, you know, I would have signed up, and then I would be exploring all the rest of their content, that they would have had me as a customer, and now they don't. I mean, I love PBS content, but I just wasn't in the mood to sign up, you know, to pay for it.
You're absolutely right. That's just the kind of thing we found in our research, and other companies have found this too, that binge, you know, in an environment where, so we know from things like Game of Thrones that people will absolutely tune in once a week with excitement to see a show that they're really excited about. But when you're trying to launch a show, the amount of engagement that you have to create to make someone care enough to schedule that on their appointment a week ahead of time, the bar is set a lot higher than it has been in the past. And there's even been, Turner did an experiment a few years ago where I think it was for The Last Ship, and I think they did this on Comcast, in some regions, they made all of the past episodes and past seasons available on demand. And in the other markets, they limited it to the rolling five from the current season or whatever it usually was. And what they found was that in the markets where all of the back episodes were available to binge, the linear ratings for new episodes of the show were much, much higher. So, you know, in an environment where anything you can do to create new linear viewers is solid gold, it turns out that one of the most powerful things you can do is make back episodes of the show available to binge you, because then that creates people, create that level of engagement, makes them care enough about the show to want to tune in on live on a weekly basis, where if you were just launching that show out into the void without that engagement to start with, people have too many other options that are available at the click of a button, and the results are not as good.
Yeah, you feel more loyal. You're completely immersed in their brand or their show, and then you'll stick around for more. Okay.
Yeah. So the other thing that makes people happy, I noted from the data, was that those with 4 or more subscriptions said they were most satisfied, which I thought was really interesting. 50% of those said that they were most satisfied. But this brings us to the next topic, which is what makes us sad. This has got this is a double-edged sword, right? Many, many subscriptions.
Yep. For sure. I mean, you know, and I think the implications of, so one of the things we found, and not just in this study, but in most of the studies we've been conducting over the last year or so, is that people are reaching what you might call a saturation point with the number of shows that are out there, but also with the number of platforms. So one of the things we asked this year, because there are some new entrants about to enter the fray, and we wanted to get a read on, you know, what sort of a marketplace are they going to step into? And we found that one question we asked is where we ask people, basically they use a slider between two extremes, and we say if a new TV subscription was available, one side, one poll is I'd add any new service as long as the content looks interesting, and then the other poll is I already have too many TV services, I'm not going to add any more. And then people can use a slider to move in between those two options to show us where they land. And this year, 24% of people were in the top three box. So the positions that were closest to, I'm not going to add any more new services because I have too many already, versus about 22% that were on the other side, I'd add a new service if the content looked interesting. The thing that's really interesting is that when we asked this question last year, only 14% of people said they had too many services. So that number, you know, there's still about 50% of people are somewhere in between the two. But the number of people who say I have too many already is almost twice as big as it was last year. And the other end of the scale hasn't grown at all. So that there's sort of a, we're also finding more than a third of people said that they wouldn't add a new service without dropping one of the ones that they have now. And that four and a half different services that I mentioned, that hasn't gone up at all since last year. So we're definitely seeing signs that people are at their maximum for how many different services they want to manage. And that to us suggests that as new services enter the market, they are going to have a higher bar to clear than in the past, when maybe people only had Netflix and can just add Hulu to that for an incremental, you know, $8 or $9 or whatever it was at the time. And there's no downside in adding one more. We think now that the new platforms that enter are going to have to win away most of their users away from some other platform that those people are using today.
You know, I've been watching all of these platforms, like all of us, for, you know, many years now. And I find that like the aggregators, especially Netflix, that they've lost a lot of content. We're aware of that. But they've lost a lot of the long tail content. They lost a lot of the interesting documentaries and all kinds of stuff that I'm interested in. And my attention starts to wane, and I start wandering around looking for other places to find that kind of stuff. I know I'm not in the mainstream. I know everybody's looking for these originals and premium this and Marvel that, Star Wars, whatever. But, you know, I think that might be an interesting, observation is that that people, like you say in your report here, that people are looking for fewer networks at a higher price, and you know, maybe the huge aggregated experience is not satisfying people anymore. Even though in your report, obviously Netflix and Hulu and Amazon are still the most popular. So I'm kind of curious why people would stay or leave these huge aggregators and look for networks that are, you know, cater to their special interests at a higher price. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, you raise a great point. I mean, one of the big takeaways from this study and a couple of other ones that we've done is that as the marketplace grows more crowded, people are actually, you know, the pay TV companies were the very first aggregators, the bundles of a couple of hundred networks aggregated together, and people swung away from that towards creating their own bundles of individual SVODs plus pay TV usually, and maybe plus a couple of other things too. But as the number of platforms that each person is using has grown, and as you pointed out a minute ago, as more of the content becomes exclusive, either because more platforms are creating their own original shows that aren't available anywhere else, or because the TV networks themselves are getting stingy with their best stuff, like CBS All Access and Star Trek, or like Disney taking back all the Marvel and Pixar, et cetera, content. People have a need to have more of these, but they're getting weary of using them all together. One of the impacts of that is that we think that they're companies that can truly aggregate across a bunch of different sources are going to have, are going to become, that's going to be an attribute that's more important to people than it's been in the past. So the two examples that we've looked at are pay TV companies who can, and in many cases already do, aggregate networks, but also will aggregate outside sources like Netflix or YouTube into video on demand results. So for example, we did some research among, not in this study, but in another one, among Comcast X1 subscribers who also have Netflix. And a very high percentage of those people had already used their Comcast box to log in and watch Netflix with. And among more than half of those people, they said that using the Comcast box was now the most common way that they use Netflix. So people very quickly acclimated to having all those Netflix results mixed in with all of the other video on demand results that they have. And they see that as a big benefit. They make, it makes it easier to use Netflix. They also see it as something that adds value to their pay TV subscription. So we see that as a role that pay TV companies are well equipped to fill. The other big aggregator is Amazon. With their Amazon channels model, most people know that you can add things like HBO or Stars to your Amazon subscription, but they also have, you know, I think 250 plus now other smaller Amazon channels that are hyper specific, but that you can add to your one monthly bill for a very low price. And many of these channels, like the ones around military history documentaries or around concert videos or the one that teaches your kids to speak Chinese, the audience for those on a practical basis is not huge. But if you're one of the people who wants one of those, you probably really want it a lot. And how great to be able to combine that, not just with all the video you aggregate through Amazon, but Amazon also aggregates your photo storage and your music and your peanut butter and your sneakers and everything else. So we think there's a big opportunity for companies that can simplify all these relationships that people are trying to manage and to simplify all the transactions they have to do and enable them to see the content that they're the most interested in without having to sift through lots of things they don't care about, which is the big tripping point for traditional pay TV bundles. As you saw in the research, and as Nielsen's published similar studies too, people only watch a very small fraction of the channels that they have available. And in many cases, you have to sort of deal with all that other content to find the 20% or so that you really care about. And it makes the discovery and navigation process a lot more work.
There are quite a lot of videos on YouTube that show you how to upload apps to your Amazon Fire TV platform that will give you all kinds of very specific content, but it's a little convoluted, but it seems to be a very flexible platform. You can't do that on Netflix. You can't do that on Apple TV or whatever it is. You know?
That's right.
Anyway, go ahead.
John, I wanted to loop back a little bit and think this is a very, the pricing issue, the cost issue, I think is a very, very important topic for us to just spend a couple of more minutes here with, because I'm wondering when you were asked them about adding another service and they were addressing their sliders, you know, trying to figure out where to set that slider, what was their reference point for the cost of the service? Did you give them one or did you just sort of leave that open?
And there were some other questions where we built theoretical costs into an exercise, kind of a build your own bundle exercise. In that question I just mentioned to you with the slider, we didn't put price in there at all. We were just trying to measure people's sort of mental bandwidth to deal with more.
Do with more, yeah.
Subscriptions, yeah. Because, I mean, it does, but for sure, I mean, price is a big part of it. And actually, that's one of the things, Colin, I know you've been writing a lot about the promise of ad-supported TV platforms, and we kind of share that point of view. You know, on one hand, as we've seen, the number of different platforms that a person is using are at an all-time high. About half of everybody now uses at least two of the big three, Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon. So those are things you pay for independently. But on top of the sort of management problem, there's also the fact that the price of a lot of these platforms is increasing. Netflix, some of the vMVPDs, the prices for those are going up, and the individual price increase on any one of them might not be a showstopper. But if you start to look at the fact that people are using four or five of these, the additive impact of a couple of them or a few of them raising their price at the same time can be big. And we think that that potentially increases the appeal of ad-supported platforms, because people can try those out and see if they like it for nothing just by paying with their time to watch ads. And a lot of these online platforms, the ad experience is so much different from what people have experienced on live TV, the smaller ad loads, the ads that are targeted to them so that they're relevant. We found that all of those things really make the ad experience more tolerable and greatly increase the appeal and engagement of folks when they are watching TV with ads in it.
Yeah, I particularly like what Hulu does, where it gives you a countdown timer. I noticed Amazon IMDb Freedive does the same thing. You get a countdown timer, which I think makes the ad experience much better. But this, you know, the big question here for me is, I wonder how price sensitive people are, because of course Disney is launching November 12th. Mm-hmm. I think they said they were going to launch. At $7 for $6.99, yep. Which is a very, very aggressive price. And most people's reference point for price is Netflix, which is between $10 and $12. So that's considerably lower. What do you think the prospects are for Disney Plus with all of this data that you've gathered? And what about Warner Media, who's already in market with HBO now at 15 and is bulking that up? What does that say about the way they can price? So why don't we Disney Plus first? What do you think about that?
I thought that was going to be a pretty compelling offer already. And then the price point when they announced that is, it's really competitive. And our takeaway for all these new services is that people, you know, most of the people we talk to who have more than one SVOD platform, the first one that they had was Netflix, almost everybody. And then later on, they added Hulu or started watching on Amazon or both. And they could do that because Netflix kind of socialized people to this idea that there could be a bottomless, or seems to be bottomless catalog of content, some of which you've heard of before and a lot of which you've never heard of before, but that the interface would be such that you could find something that you enjoy within there. And people got excited about the idea of adding one more catalog or maybe two more catalogs to that. But as I said, now we've reached the point where people have access to three, four, four and a half different bottomless catalogs of content. So any service that comes along and just offers more of that is probably, it's going to be a harder, people don't really need any more content to look at. And original shows are compelling, but since every platform has those now, they're also not really a differentiator. So we think that these new platforms are going to need to have a really compelling combination of content you can't get anywhere else and a price point that makes it a good deal. And so Disney Plus would seem to have that covered in spades with the name brand destination content they're going to be offering that also, by the way, is not going to be available where people used to find it before, and a price point that's very low. And I don't know if prognostication is my complete specialty, but to me, it seems like a winner of a proposition for the average consumer.
It's interesting in your report that you state, and that people are happy about the existence of live TV in their platforms, and yet they're very sad if there isn't any live TV, and that you rate that as the number three important. Number three on your list, both what they like least and what they like best. And I think that's a very interesting observation, because that has nothing to do with all this on-demand interactive mm-hmm. content. And so the rise and the importance of live TV and local television and yep. news and things like that, I think is an area worth investigating. In fact, we're going to be doing several sessions about how news is going to be changing streaming platforms and the live TV, you know, business. I mean, that I think is an important observation. And, you know, curious if, excuse me, if these huge aggregators that are going to be delivered, you know, offered, like we were just discussing, are going to be, you know, investing in live television, because obviously that's people want that. I don't know if they want it because of news or sports or just they want to watch commercials in the context. But what do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, live TV is, everybody talks about sort of the death of live TV. And really what's happening, though, is the death of live as sort of the default for TV. So there's lots of things that you know, there's not really any reason to watch them live. So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily go watch a live rerun of Friends that happens to be on at a certain time of day when you can go on an SVOD platform and find any episode you wanted of Friends and watch it right from the beginning instead of having to jump in the middle. You know, that doesn't make any more sense than if the new Harry Potter book comes up, but the only way you can read it is to go to Barnes and Noble at 9 p.m. and J.K. Rowling reads it out loud to you. So for a lot of catalog content, there isn't a reason to watch it live, but there are still many, many things that we find people say the default way they would watch it is live. And so, of course, sports events, news, but also things where there's some reason, there's some kind of currency to see it at the same time that everybody else does. And those are things like the season premiere or season finale or series finale of really big shows. There's also a lot of innovation happening, you know, not that maybe I think there could be more, but there is innovation happening now with live TV. That's content that creates a reason to watch it live, like that show Live PD that follows different police units around the country with mm-hmm. live cameras and kind of jumps back and forth between them, like the live Broadway shows on NBC and Fox. Those all give people a reason to tune in live and watch them, and they have greater success, therefore, than a lot of the shows that that are live equivalents of things you could find on demand. And among people that have cut the cord, usually what we find that they miss the most are live TV and local channels. So even though those aren't, you know, as sexy to talk about as whatever the newest original drama is, they're still kind of staples of television that most people have a use for. That's one reason that I was really interested to hear about the new Fox's upfront presentation, where they are creating a much smaller, more nimble company that's going to focus specifically on new sports and live events, because, you know, we think there's a lot of innovation to be done there and a lot of things that, you know, people haven't given up on that as much as what you read in the news would suggest that. And there's a lot of room, we think, to innovate, to make the things that people really want to have live even better than they have been before, and even gather the maximum audience that they can.
Yeah, I think it's important to notice, like I said, it's number three. The first one is exclusive shows, a variety of shows, then in live TV, then the ability to watch your shows on schedule, and then you have 15 other specific things that people wanted or didn't want underneath that. But I just wanted to bring that up because we think live TV and the topic of news and things like that is a very important area for innovation. I agree. But it gives the MVPDs, you know, a lot of power and to mm-hmm. be the main service that people want to sign up for.
And of course, it gives Sinclair with Stir and you know, CBS with CBS All Access. And one assumes that NBC is going to be doing something very similar with the service that they deliver next year. So yeah, this John, this data is great data, really interesting. What's the name of the report again? And tell us how people can get it.
Sure. This one's called The Best Bundle, and this is part of one of our subscription series of studies that we publish. There's six studies a year that each one deals with a different topic, from perceived value, what types of features and content are people most willing to pay for. There's one on TV discovery. There's one on the evolution of video, which covers a lot of the stuff, Tracy, you mentioned about digital first video and YouTube content. So that's a subscription that people can buy, but also we give away some of the findings for free on our website a couple of months after we publish each study. So if you go to hubresearchllc.com, you can download an excerpt of this report or any of the other reports that we've done going back to 2014.
I just want to comment that I thought this report, and you didn't pay me to say this, but I think this report was well laid out, well designed. The information was very easy to glean. And so I commend you on
I appreciate that. Thank you.
This particular project. And also, we're going to be talking about bundles and news and OTT all over the place at TVOT coming up June 12th and 13th. Little promo for me. I am paid to say that because I own the company. But
you're not paying me to say it. But it looks like a great show, and I haven't missed one in the last few years. So it looks like it's going to be great again this time.
Yeah.
And I'm not paid to say it either. But as our audience knows, I am always at Tracy's TV promotion show. It's great. So, John, thank you so much for sharing that. It's I think this has been a great prep for anybody that's going to be attending our show. If they want to get more, they should come to your website and dig into some of that data. Thank you so much, John. And Tracy, I think we're pretty much out of time.
We are. John, come to the show anytime.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Okay, no problem. We love you. Be sure to check out Colin's sessions at the show and check us out at the TV of Tomorrow show. Tea Time is at itvt.com/podcast and on endscreenmedia.com. Colin's site. Thank you so much.
We'll see you again soon.